Welcome. This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report, and it is the 31st of October 2011, and today I'm talking to Michael Hudson, who is the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He's a Wall Street financial analyst, a distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and the author of Super Imperialism, The Economic Strategy of American Empire, Trade, Development, and Foreign Debt, and The Myth of Aid. Very interesting and colored history. I'm sure there are many, many, many more accolades to go through there, but that's just the short form biography. Michael Hudson, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I understand that you've written and talked extensively about, obviously, economic uncertainty and problems happening all over the world. But I understand you've also talked about the Icelandic uncertainty as well and talked to various people involved in the new Icelandic government. And I think a lot of the listeners and viewers out there are aware to a certain extent of what has happened, what has transpired in Iceland over the recent years and the really beginnings of the austerity protests in Iceland itself. But perhaps you can go over a little bit of that history and give us a timeline of when those events transpired.
Well, the problem occurred, of course, throughout the entire world in September of 2008, right after Lehman Brothers fell apart. This brought down the three Icelandic banks that were run by kleptocrats. Some of them apparently in conjunction with Russian criminals. We're not sure, but the Icelandic banks were the most overextended, including foreign branches and affiliates in England and in Holland. Many people are aware of the fact that Gordon Brown threatened to use his clout within the IMF to demand that the International Monetary Fund and the European community make England pay for Iceland pay for its English bank affiliates that were supposed to have been regulated under British law, although, as we know, the British were just as deregulatory and irresponsible as the George Bush administration was. And Gordon Brown lashed out and said, essentially wanted to push Iceland into half a century of debt serfdom in order to pay money that it didn't owe. The Icelanders, right after the bank crash, had elected a social democratic and green government, expecting that they would be the alternative to the neoliberals. And the result was just the opposite. The socialist government, social democrats in Iceland, were way to the right of the neoliberals, and they insisted that Iceland pay whatever Gordon Brown wanted as the price for joining the European community and joining the euro. The president of Iceland, whose job was simply that of a notary public, in effect, to sign off on a law, said, wait a minute, if we're going to push a country into half a century of poverty and force half a century worth of the population to emigrate, they have to have a vote on it. Otherwise, it's not legal under international law. So they had a referendum, and the vast majority of Icelanders said, no, we don't want to pay. The social democratic government pleaded and pleaded and finally forced another referendum. And once again, the population said no. They tried to throw out the social democratic government, but they say, we're in and we're not going to give up power. A few weeks ago, they tried to make another giveaway to crooked bankers, and the Icelanders had their own version of the Occupy Wall Street protests. They got these 22-gallon oil drums, stood outside the parliament, and banged the oil drums so loudly that the attempt was to stop parliament from doing the bank giveaway. And here's what the public has not known about the Icelandic bank collapse and what happened after 2008. The International Monetary Fund came in and recommended that the government solve the crooked bank problem by letting other private bankers buy the bonds of the bank, buy ownership of the banks. The stockholders were wiped out, but the bonds were bought at about 10 cents on the dollar by essentially vulture investors, whose own websites describe them as troubled asset specialists. That means vulture investors buying at just a few cents on the dollar. The government made what seems to be an agreement with them, saying, "Okay, we're going to write down, we're going to break up these bank holdings into the good bank, where there are some sound debts to Icelanders, and the bad bank that has the bad assets. And we understand that you're going, since you bought the bank debts at say 30 cents on the dollar, you're going to write down the debts to the ability to pay, which is 30 cents on the dollar, which is what you yourself have bought the banks for." Instead, the vulture banks waited for the Social Democrats to come in, and having a right-wing socialist government, which has nothing to do with socialism as we English language speakers use the term, it's what we used to call fascism, quite frankly. They said, "Okay, we're going to let the bankers act, the vulture investors act very much like a debt collector would act in the United States or Canada. You take over the debt and you hound the debtors and you get whatever you can out of them." Now, when it comes to whatever you can get out of the debtors, there's something very unique to Iceland that doesn't exist in any other country. The labor union leaders have put much of their money into the financial sector, and they have the labor union leaders have pushed a law indexing the debts, the mortgage debts and the personal debts, to the consumer price index. Now, when Iceland's banks collapsed, the currency collapsed. It was just an absolute plunge in the currency, so that naturally the price of imports went way up and the consumer price index went way up. So the vulture investors that bought these banks at 30 cents on the dollar get to not only collect the 100%, they're going after 100% of the mortgage debt, but they're going after the index principal that is much larger than the original mortgage debt. There was a meeting, the whole issue of indexing debt to foreign exchange has been outlawed by the Icelandic constitution. The socialist government has unilaterally suspended the constitution and is running by fiat, saying their loyalty is to the banking and financial sector, not to the population. Last Thursday, there was a meeting convened by the IMF and to mobilize support for the Icelandic government. Paul Krugman was there. Martin Wolf of the Financial Times was there. John Danielsson, Icelandic economist, was there. And they pretty much took the government apart and took Paul Krugman apart and his sort of liberal support of the government, saying, "Well, you don't want to really shake things up." I haven't been able to, I've been at my own meetings in Germany, in Berlin, at the Buckler Foundation meetings, where we were so busy, I haven't been able to access this yet, but I've just read the reports that the meeting was a disaster for the government, which means a victory for common sense in establishing the principle that a debt that can't be paid won't be paid. It was pointed out that since the last census just a few years ago, 8% of Iceland's total population has had to emigrate to avoid the debt plunge. People are in negative equity. Most of the Icelanders of working age have left for Norway and other countries in order to find work. The situation in Iceland is becoming as bad as it was in Latvia, which is the neoliberal success story, where they've lowered wages in the public sector by 30% and forced one-third of the population between the ages of 20 and 35 to plan to emigrate in the next few years, and are emptying out the population there. So what you're having is a financial war against the population as a whole. The approval rating of the Icelandic government by its people is reported to be 10%. That's even worse than the U.S. approval rating of Congress, and there's nothing that they can do. The last local election was won in Reykjavik by a comedian that started a kind of nonsense party, and people voted the comedian in instead of the professional politicians, out of recognition of the fact that most Iceland is such a small country, about 800,000 people, that people are interrelated, and the parliament is thoroughly involved in the bank giveaways and the kickbacks, and is thoroughly corrupt. And people think of Iceland as being a social democracy like the Scandinavian countries, but it's an ingrown insider dealing government, and the insider dealing is so closely entrenched with the financial sector that it's almost as bad as things are in the United States, where Goldman Sachs gets to appoint the Treasury Secretary and appointed the bank lobbyist Tim Geithner in charge of financial policy, appointed the deregulator Eric Holder as in the Justice Department to make sure that no financial criminal is prosecuted at all for criminal crime, which prevents the civil victims of the U.S. financial ripoff from getting redress against the exploitation by Countrywide Finance, the Bank of America, Citibank, and other organizations that my UMKC colleague Bill Black says is a criminalized financial system. So you're having Iceland as an example of this criminalization. Bill Black has gone there. I've gone there. It's an example of the criminalization that's been taking place to the point that finance is the new mode of warfare. Internationally, finance aims at the same thing that a military invasion aims for. It wants the land, it wants the mineral resources, and it wants the nation to pay tribute. That's what's happened in Iceland. The vast majority of houses held on mortgage are in negative equity because the prices have plunged as the economy's been financially wrecked. Foreign investors have made insider dealings with the government to get volcanic power to power aluminum refineries that yield almost nothing at all to Iceland because they don't make a profit. They don't make a profit because all of the enormous real profits and cash flow they make is paid out in the form of interest to affiliates by Alcan and Alcoa. So it's all a kind of financial fictitious economy, certainly fictitious statistics that deprive Iceland of getting any money, and the government has done absolutely nothing about this. The main resource of Iceland is the fisheries, where there were contracts given very much like taxicab licenses in New York, a given amount of contracts for fisheries that enriched the political insiders who got the contracts. Many of these are pledged for foreign debts and have also been forfeited to foreigners. So all of a sudden, it's as if Iceland has been occupied by foreigners. But the occupation hasn't been military. It's been financial. And the effect is just the same. The foreign-owned banks, the vulture funds, are now taking the land. They're taking whatever the government can privatize. And they're demanding enormous tribute from the Icelandic population to pay the vulture funds. That's why there was a meeting last Thursday. And that's why the Icelanders are out in the streets in their own protest.
Well, that's right. And obviously, the Icelandic example raises the idea of odious debt, which is actually somewhat of an old concept, but it's one that Iceland is applying really at such a level for maybe the first time. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about that principle and where it comes from.
It was developed around the time of World War I, at a time when debts were loaded onto countries without the population's approval. It was done, but for instance, the Russian debt was an example. The Tsars and the pre-communist government, when they saw that they were going to fall, they borrowed a huge amounts from American and British banks to be paid into their own personal accounts right out of the government budget as long as they could control it. Their spirit was take the money and run. Just like the American bank, Citibank, and the Wall Street new banks, such as Goldman Sachs, took bailout money, paid it to themselves as bonuses and salaries, paid it and used the money as offshore accounts, and essentially looted the U.S. Government of $13 trillion added to the U.S. National debt, not to do what governments are supposed to do, which is invest in improving society and long-term plans, but simply to pay an elite that gives the government money over to themselves. The idea is that a debt that is done in the name of a country but is turned over to political insiders for their own benefit should not have to be repaid out of taxpayers. If you look in Wikipedia, you'll see the definition of legal definition of odious debt. A number of us have asked the Icelanders to begin to apply this, but as long as you have a social fascist government that supports the banking system, they've of course refused. Not only do they refuse to apply the process of odious debt, they want to increase the debt even further. They've been accused of payoffs among the leading social democratic politicians. And indeed, some of the green politicians who are in the coalition have resigned from the government in protest to what essentially is a criminalized occupation government, but they have not been able to succeed against the vicious social democracy that is ruling Iceland with an iron hand and refusing to reflect the will of the people. Now, what this does is very interesting because initially, for a few centuries, from about the 16th century through the 19th century, finance was actually on the side of democracy. And it was on the side of democracy for a very interesting reason. It stems from the War of the Habsburg Spanish against the Low Countries, against Netherlands, Belgium, and the other countries. There was a fight for independence of the Netherlands against the Habsburgs. And the Habsburgs tried to borrow from the Fuggers and from the other financiers. But a problem was that at that time in the 16th century, when you would lend to a king, the debt died when the king died. So many British bankers, many Italian bankers had gone bankrupt by lending to British monarchs because when the king died, it wasn't owed. The Netherlands introduced parliamentary democracy and they said, okay, we're going to contract on behalf of the entire country to borrow the money that we need at a time when money is the sinews of war and credit is the sinews of war. They needed to borrow the money to fight for independence against Spain. And so the international bankers lent the money to the Netherlands, not to the Habsburg, because the Netherlands developed the concept of a permanent public debt that would be agreed upon by Parliament. This enabled democracies throughout the world to begin to replace autocracies and royalty because they were creditworthy and they could get the credit to fight for their freedom. Well, obviously, that's now all over, and now finance has thrown in its interest with oligarchies and with dictatorships because they can agree to pay the debts, and that's what makes these debts so odious, that they're taken on without public approval by a insider group. The same is happening with Greece's socialist government. The reason there are so many demonstrations and general strikes out in Greece is to make it clear to international creditors that the population is completely against paying these debts and that these debts are imposed by a government against the will of the people, so that when the people finally get an election, when they can throw out social dictators, they can then, under international law, repudiate the debt and say, look, you European central bankers gave the money to your own banks to bail them out. You're not going to add the money that you gave your own banks for bad investments. You're not going to make us taxpayers pay for your bailout and their mistakes. You knew that we all disapproved of it. You saw the general strike. You saw the people out in the streets. So you had fair warning that as soon as we came in, we're going to annul the debts. And there's very little that Europe can do about this because the European Central Bank doesn't have any troops. The financial warfare is a warfare that doesn't entail the military warfare of times past. So you remember in World War II, the Vatican was denouncing Russia and Stalin quipped, well, how many troops does the Pope control? Well, right now the Greeks are saying, ha, how many troops and infantry does the European Central Bank have? There's very little that they can do against this, and they're going to throw down the gauntlet, and this is going to be, I guess, taken into court for many years, and it's finally bringing up the concept not only of odious debts, but even debts that aren't odious, even debts that are owed by the people as mortgage debts, as student loans, as credit card debts, as bank debts, the debts owed by cities and states and governments and by corporations. There's a basic principle at work, and that is that a debt that can't be paid won't be paid. And there's one way or another, the question is going to be just how won't these debts be paid? Will they be paid in a way that tears the economy apart and creates international tensions? Or is it going to be recognized that the debt process has reached its limit? I think at the conference I was at the Bockler Foundation in Berlin over financialization, there's a general realization that the game is over. The debts can't increase anymore because everybody's already indebted up to the hilt. The debt system can only be maintained if bankers lend debtors enough money to pay the interest and amortization falling due. Well, this is how Latin America got by in the 1970s, how Brazil and Argentina and Mexico functioned until finally, in 1982, Mexico announced it lacked the money to pay. And the bank said, well, don't go bankrupt because then we have to write it off our balance sheet. The result was that the bankers didn't force Mexico into bankruptcy. What happened was the Brady Plan to write down all of the overgrowth of Latin American and third world debt into Brady bonds at some fraction of the original debt at a rate that could be paid. And that enabled much of Latin America at least to get going again, even with the debt burden that it has. Something like that has been suggested for the Greek debt, the Irish debt, and the other debt. But the link should be made, I think, between Iceland and Greece. Is it okay if I talk about that? For better, am I wandering on?
No, top? Please, please do.
The last Wednesday, the Europeans group got together and asked the banks to write down their debt by 70%. The banks said, no, we control you, the government. How dare you ask us to take a haircut? We are not going to permit you to voluntarily write down the debt. That would be a default. And so the Institute for International Economics, which is the bank lobbyist in Europe, said, "Okay, here's a settlement that we propose. You're going to do what we say. We are going to ask our members to voluntarily write down their Greek debt to 50% of the face value." And this is very much like what they did last February. Last February, they asked the banks voluntarily to write down their debts to by 30%. They promised that they'd get 80% of the bankers to agree. In fact, less than 70%, we don't know how much, but less than 70% agreed, and there was no debt write down. So now the Institute of Economics is saying, well, we have to keep it voluntarily and ask our banks to write down the debts by 50%. Nobody in Europe that I know expects the banks to do this. This is a face-saving operation. The stock market went up, the bank shares went up, and the insiders all began selling their bank shares to suckers. What you saw last week was a sucker's rally of people believing that this promise to ask the banks to write down the debts would actually take place in practice. And of course, it was all a trick. And you know it's a trick for the following reason. Immediately, the lawyers for the, first of all, Tim Geithner, the bank lobbyist from America, went over and told Europe, well, wait a minute, the American banks have written credit default swaps against Greek bonds. You can't write down the debts because that would bankrupt the U.S. banks, and they have over $1 trillion, maybe $10 trillion of bets on this. You can't make us lose the money that we've bet, or then we bet. You have to take the loss, so you can't write down the bank loans. Well, some of the banks now are saying, well, okay, I understand that Geithner's told the Europeans that they can't write them down, so it's all voluntary, but what about these credit default swaps? If there is a write-down down that's negotiated with the European governments, is this money that we can now collect under a credit default swap agreement or not? Well, this is going to keep the lawyers busy for at least 10 years, or as long as it took the Exxon company to negotiate the Alaskan oil spill. These banks are in the jerk-around business, basically. And the banks are going to say, the holders of the insurers of the credit default swaps are going to say, wait a minute, that wasn't a default. We didn't ensure that you wouldn't lose money in the free market, and what you have is a free market reduction in the price of the Greek bonds. There's been no way you can collect, so the American companies won't pay the Europeans, and this will go to some international court sometime in late in the 21st century. I've suggested that the Greeks not pay any money at all until the courts decide exactly how to settle this problem, and that they put it in abeyance, and a Greek television team came up to Berlin yesterday and interviewed me on this, and I understand that that idea is now being put into play in Greece. But it's the kind of fictitious nonsense over what kind of a just-pretend world are we going to have, a just-pretend world in which the debts are supposed to be paid, just-pretend world in which they won't be paid, but the insurers are going to have to pay. What kind of fiction are we going to live in? That really is the kind of interim that the world is living in financially at the present time.
Well, then, getting back to the Icelandic example, then, I think it is straightforward what the Icelandic people have to do, which is obviously throw off the government, which is clearly on the side of the banking oligarchy, and to declare themselves free of this debt. But how to get there, of course, is a different matter entirely.
And you can only throw out a government when it comes time to vote. Same as in Greece. Of course the Greeks want to throw out the social fascist government there. How can they do it if there's no opportunity to vote? We're not about to have an armed revolution, certainly not in Iceland. We're not in the Viking Age anymore. So there's really a kind of interregnum where nobody knows what to do. And I think that's what the frustration is in the Occupy Wall Street in America. You're having exactly the same thing. There's an awareness that the political system has broken down along with the financial system. What do you do in a case like that? There's a frustration and an anger at the fact that the political system is broken down so that people don't have a chance to vote like the Icelanders did on a referendum. At least the Icelanders were able to say, we're not going to pay Gordon Brown money we don't owe, send it to the European court. Unfortunately, at the European Banking Court and Central Bank is thoroughly corrupt and refuses to follow the rule of law. Last April or May, at a Levy Institute Minsky conference, there was a European Central Banker there, and I asked, what are you going to do? How are you going to rule in this case where Iceland doesn't really owe the money to the bank, Britain's bank authority? And the official said, we will do our clientele are the banks. Our clientele is the Bank of England. Regardless of the rule of law, we are going to do whatever they say because we are the law. What that means is that in the financial sphere, the rule of law is over. You know the rule is over when in the United States, not a single financial official has been prosecuted for the junk mortgage, toxic waste criminalization that has led to the $13 trillion bank bailout. You've seen all of this giveaway at public expense. You've seen $13 trillion added to the public debt, headed by the $5.3 trillion of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac mortgage debt, $2 trillion of the Federal Reserve cash for trash swaps, where the Federal Reserve has taken the toxic waste and the junk mortgages, credited them at face value as deposits, and let the banks draw out the money. The $800 billion QE2 quantitative easing that the Federal Reserve did last summer to let the banks send all this money abroad to speculate in foreign currencies currencies, driving down the dollar against the Australian dollar and other foreign currencies. You've seen this huge giveaway of essentially making the financial sector as tax-exempt, income tax-exempt, as the real estate sector has been since World War II, or the oil sector. So you're having a huge tax shift off of what I call, what a national income economists call, the FIRE sector. Finance, insurance, and real estate have essentially not only been made tax-free, but they're getting most of the government funds at a price that involves the government cutting back its social spending on Social Security, Medicare, normal social spending and welfare. And you're having a shift away from parliamentary economic democracy into financial oligarchy. That's the shift that's happening today, and this is a world historic shift. This is the battle right now. Will the world, Iceland, Greece, the United States, Canada, England, Europe, have a economic democracy, or will it be a financial oligarchy that essentially its answer to government planning is debt peonage? Instead of serfdom, people can live wherever they want, but they're going to have to pay all of the economic surplus over and above their basic break-even needs out to the financial sector. Is this the kind of world we're going to have?
Very good question. Well, I guess other than beating on 22-gallon oil drums, is there anything people can actually do about this in this interregnum?
Well, you're seeing a pre-revolutionary situation in the Occupy Wall Street all over the United States, and now that it's spread to other countries. What this is doing is letting people know that what they've intuitively felt all along, what they've suspected, that the system is broken, that there are a lot of other people that feel like them. And there are many people all along who've thought, am I the only person who thought this? Very similar to the Tunisian revolution that started Arab Spring. My Tunisian graduates of the UMKC that are teaching now have explained to me that all of a sudden everybody came out and talked to each other in the demonstrations and said, do you feel this way too? Do you agree the government's thoroughly corrupt and there has to be a change? They said it was a wonderful feeling. People were exchanging their phone numbers and exchanging food. That's the kind of thing you're having a breakthrough now. The people have said, gee, we felt that the system was going off the rails, not only financially, but politically. And it doesn't have to be this way. And once you have people getting together, and there's a kind of mass of peer pressure saying, it doesn't have to be this way, you're preparing the ground for a way to resist this oligarchic financial political counter-revolution against the Enlightenment, against classical political economy. And the question is, what are we going to call it? What's going to take its place? I don't know what to call it. You can't call it socialism because you have a social democratic party to the right in Iceland. You have a socialist government completely in the hands of the bankers in Greece. You have the socialist parties all over the world taking the reverse position of what the social democrats and labor party stood for a century ago. So it's probably going to be another name. Nobody's come up with a name yet. I guess in the 19th century United States, you had the Populist Party, the Greenback Party, the Progressive Party. Who knows what there's going to be? But out of this common awareness that there's a problem, this stage is now defining what the problem is. And out of that, once you can define a problem thoroughly enough and correctly enough, you're going to have a political movement to say, okay, the definition of the problem almost by itself defines the solution. That's probably going to take at least a year. I don't think you're going to find it in next year's U.S. elections, because the Obama administration is, if anything, to the right of Michelle Bachmann and the craziest Republicans that at least say to the voters, we were against the bailout from the beginning. We voted against it in 2008. And we're against it now. When Obama is has put the financial, the Wall Street lobbyists in control of America's economic policy. I've heard it suggested that the one reason to vote against, not to vote for Obama, and in a way to hope that a Republican president comes in, is if a Republican president tried to do what President Obama has done, the Democratic Congress or Senate would vote against it, would block it. They can't block it when a Democratic president takes a Republican policy and pushes a Wall Street policy for us, so that they're bewildered. They're perplexed. How does a Democratic Congress deal with a Democratic president that's to the right of the Republican Party and is a complete demagogue who says he's for change, but he turns out to be the third Bush administration, in effect, or the fifth Clinton administration, you could say, or even the eighth, the Reagan administration. You've had every administration push a neoliberal line against the wishes of the American people, to a point that has bankrupted the economy and left it in negative equity, where people have to spend their entire lifetime repaying student debts that they've taken on that they can't erase through bankruptcy, and they can't pay out of their jobs because they're unemployed. So you have this unpayable debt carried onto the books. That's what makes the debt situation and the financial situation so basically fictitious. It's a debt that can't be paid, so we're back to the issue is when a debt can't be paid, it won't be, but will it not be paid by foreclosure, by letting the creditors say, okay, you can't pay Greece, give us your land, give us your islands, let us privatize the Athenian water and sewer system, give us the Parthenon. Well, that's the attitude that the United States government had towards England after World War I for the inter-allied debts. Congressmen suggested that England give us the British Museum and other treasures. This is the kind of argument that has been going on for a century, and this the financial sector realizes this crisis. President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, put it well. He said, a crisis is too important to waste. So their attitude is, let's not let it go to waste. This is the time for a power elite all over the world, in America, Iceland, and Greece, to grab everything they can, take the money and give it to themselves, stash it in offshore island enclaves where governments can't go after it, and to become a new cosmopolitan financial elite, plunging the world economy into debt peonage. That's their plan. The question is, what will the people do to resist it? That's what's being decided now in all the demonstrations you have, from Occupy Wall Street to Iceland to Greece to the United Kingdom and the rest of the world.
All right, Michael Hudson, michaelhudson.com. A very, very thorough analysis. Thank you very much for your time tonight. Well, let's leave it at
that.
Sorry, michael-hudson.com. Thank you very much.
Not a dash, a hyphen. That's the only way to get it.
Okay.
But at any rate, you can Google it and it'll put you through.